This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
So I think this is my fourth year to come and give a talk. It's always nice to be here. Shaila is a good friend as well as someone I really admire, so it's nice to come and be with your group, even though she's not here. So it's nice when she's here too. So I feel like I have to give the preamble that I often give, which is that I'm an academic, and I apologize for that. So my talks are often, because I do read Pali, which is the language of the original text of the historical Buddha, the Pali canon, I often use the Pali in my talks, and I unpack the Pali and talk about the etymology and how it fits together in the teachings. This is stuff that I really get excited about. And you all indulge me, and it's very nice. And I've been invited back, so I must have not alienated everybody. But I didn't do that this time. So I wanted to take the opportunity to... I'm going to talk about the suttas that I've chosen, but I'm not going to spend time going through the Pali. My topic, so I've chosen two lesser known suttas. One is a sutta and one is a collection. And the sutta is the Chanki Sutta, or they say the Chanki Sutta. And they say the way to remember that is like chunky peanut butter. I don't think that's probably what the original founders of the canon were thinking, but... if it helps, it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses. And so the topic that on how to choose a trustworthy teacher is, I think, one that's permeates all of Buddhism. As we know, the Buddha had many teachers. And he went through a lot of, I think he had five or six very important teachers that we hear about before his enlightenment. And though sometimes it's told that, you know, he learned these different techniques and became very austere and they didn't really work, take him all the way, he says that it was a combination of these things and working with them all this time that then allowed him to develop his own awakening, or to move towards awakening, or to find out what was missing. And so... it's important to keep in mind that finding a trustworthy teacher, if it was good enough for the Buddha, then it's probably good enough for us to think about it. And of course, this is not to say that teachers are untrustworthy, but what's interesting to me about this is that there are many suttas talking about how do you find a trustworthy teacher? You know, how do you find someone that... And by trustworthy, we mean someone who, you know, is going to teach to us. You know, someone who's going to, you know, one of the most important characteristics of a teacher is someone we feel an affinity with, right? There's probably many good teachers out there that, you know, that I've met teachers that other people were just raving about. They were just the most fabulous people in the whole universe, but I just didn't feel a connection. And vice versa, sometimes I feel a strong connection to someone who other people don't. So the Chanki Sutta is interesting because the Buddha actually talks about what one does to find a good teacher. Chanki, the Brahmin Chanki, actually has nothing to do with the sutta, which is interesting in itself. He is the setting is that the Buddha is as common in the suttas. If you're familiar with the suttas, he is traveling with his monks and nuns. And he is staying at the land of someone, of a king, and a great collection of Brahmins. Brahmin high-ranking Brahmin scholars who were, you know, very well educated and considered the religious elite in India then and now in certain areas of India. So they found out that the Buddha, the Gautama Buddha, they called him Master Gautama in the sutta, was giving discourse down the road a bit, and the Brahmin Chanki wanted to go hear him, and it begins by his servant saying, don't go hear him, he should come hear you. You're the high-ranking Brahmin here. And he goes through this whole thing, you're handsome and you're rich and you're a landowner, and he says, you've been given all this property by the king, and clearly, you're the chosen one by the gods, and all these things. But Chanki says, I really want to go hear him. So let's go. And a whole group of Brahmins go. And so that's where we enter the scene. And you'll get, if you haven't really read the suttas or know much about the suttas, the Buddha often he engages in this kind of Socratic dialogue where he, he's asking questions and he leads the interlocutors into finding answers by the kind of questions that he asks. So it's a very skillful way of teaching, of course. So I'm going to read you a few little excerpts just so you can get the tone of it. Now, on that occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was seated, finishing some amiable talk with some of the very senior Brahmins. At the time, sitting in the assembly was a Brahmin student named Kapatika. Young, shaven-headed, 16 years old, he was a master of the three Vedas with the vocabularies, liturgy, phonology, and etymology, and the histories as a fifth. Skilled in philology and grammar, he was fully versed in natural philosophy and in the marks of a great man. So in other words, he was a cocky teenager. While the very senior Brahmins were conversing with the Blessed One, he repeatedly broke in and interrupted their talk. Then the Blessed One rebuked the Brahmin student, Kapatika, thus saying, "Let not the venerable," and then he changes his name. I don't know why I looked to try to find out why the Buddha did this, but he calls him Bharadvaja, which I understand is perhaps from his clan name. "Let not the venerable Bharadvaja break in and interrupt the talk of the very senior Brahmins while they are conversing. Let the venerable Bharadvaja," I'm going to call him Kapatika, "wait until the talk is finished." When this was said, the Brahmin Kanki said to the Blessed One, "Let not Master Gautama rebuke the Brahmin student Kapatika." The Brahmin student Kapatika is a clansman. He is very learned. He has a very good delivery, and he is wise. He is capable of taking part in this discussion with Master Gautama. So the Blessed One thought, "Surely, since the Brahmins honor him thus, the Brahmin student must be accomplished in the scriptures of the Veda." Then the Brahmin student had a thought. He thinks, "When the recluse Gautama catches my eye, I shall ask him a question." I love this about the suttas. They're so human. I mean, how many of us have done that in our lives? You don't know somebody, you're going to wait till they look at you, and then you're going to, kind of try to engage them. But the Buddha, of course, is a mind reader. He shows up as a mind reader all the time in the suttas, and he says, "Then knowing with his own mind the thought in the Brahmin student's mind, the Blessed One turns his eye towards him. Then the Brahmin student Kapatika thought, 'The recluse Gautama is looking toward me. Suppose I ask him a question.' And then he asked, 'Master Gautama, in regard to the ancient Brahmanic hymns that have come down through oral transmission, preserved in the collections, the Brahmins come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is wrong. What does Master Gautama think of this?'" So if you may know that the Vedas, the Brahmin scriptures, were memorized and passed down only to the Brahmins in their original Sanskrit. At the time, no one else was taught to read Sanskrit. It was a protected language from this particular caste, and was the sign of great spiritual elitism, really. And then the Course of Buddha begins, and he says, well, how then, young man, among the Brahmins, is there even a single Brahmin who says thus, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong? And the young man says, no, they don't say that. He says, well, how then, among the Brahmins, is there even a single man that says, a single teacher says, but even from going back from the seventh generation, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong? He says, no, they don't say that either. The ones who composed the hymns, whose ancient hymns were formerly chanted, uttered, and compiled, the Brahmins nowadays still chant and repeat those recited from long ago. Did they ever say, we know this, we see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong? No, Master Gautama. So it seems that among the Brahmins, there is not even a single Brahmin who says this, I know this, I see this, only this is true, anything else is wrong. And among the Brahmins, there is not even a single teacher that says, I know this, I see this. And the ancient Brahmin seers, the creators of the hymns, they don't even say, I know this, I see this. Suppose there was a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. So too, in regard to their statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. What do you think? That being so, does not the faith of the Brahmins turn out to be groundless? So, you know, this is a whole religion he's talking about, right? So, and then the young man says, well, the Brahmins honor not just out of faith, they also honor out of oral tradition. And, of course, the Buddha says, first you took your stand on faith, now you speak of the oral tradition. And then he says, there are five things that may turn out in two different ways in the here and now. What five? Faith, approval, oral tradition, reasoned cognition, reflective acceptance of a view. That's translated differently, and I was going to give you another translation, but we'll stick with that for now. These five things may be empty, hollow, and false, but something else may not be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be factual, true, and unmistaken. Again, something may be fully approved of, well transmitted, well cogitated, well reflected upon, and yet it may be empty and false. But something else may be well reflected upon, and it may be factual true. Under these conditions, it is not proper for a wise man who preserves truth to come to the definite conclusion, only this is true, anything else is false. But Master Gautama, in what way is there a preservation of truth? How does one preserve truth? We ask Master Gautama about the preservation of truth. And the answer is, if a person has faith, he preserves the truth. My faith is thus. But he doesn't come to a definite conclusion, only this is true. In this way, young man, this is the preservation of truth. In this way, he preserves truth. In this way, we describe the preservation of truth, but as yet, there is no discovery of truth. So you see where the Buddha is going with this. Right? So it's one thing to quote scripture, chant, but have you seen ehipasiko, right? That is the, you know, to come and see, to experience for the truth for oneself. He says that it's one thing. So the reflective acceptance, he does not have a definite conclusion, and there's not a way to discover the truth. And so the young man asks him, how do you go about discovering the truth? And here's the answer where we get to the teachers. He says, if a teacher comes to your neighborhood and opens a Dharma center down the road, first you want to do is you want to go and spend time on them, and you want to see how do they respond in terms of greed. Are they greedy? Do they have hate? Do they have a sense, can you discern any delusion in them? And then you investigate these things. You investigate how they are in terms of greed. You investigate how they are in terms of hate. And you investigate how they are in terms of delusion. This is very wise, isn't it? Because you want to find someone who, this is where the trust comes in. Right? Someone that you think, well, this person shows, you know, these are the qualities I'd like to have. I'd like to not be greedy, not be burdened by hate. Hate is a big deal right now, isn't it? Like, we're hearing a lot about hate. Oh, I don't even want to think about it. People talk to me about politics, and I just want to read them the Kanki Sutta. But then, you know, so he says, well, what do I do? How do I go about finding this person? And he said, well, you have to pay attention to the wise that come in proximity to you. And when they're in proximity to you, you want to investigate their purified states. And what you want to do is follow their instructions. If they don't have the greed, hate, and delusion, and you want to do this by going to the person and being with them, having paid, you want to go to them, you want to visit them, then you want to pay respects to them. After paying respect to them, you want to give them ear, you want to hear what they have to say, you want to hear their Dhamma teachings, and then you want to memorize their Dhamma teachings. And after you memorize it, you want to examine the meaning of it. And after you examine the meaning of it, you want to reflect and see if you accept those teachings. And when you have gained a reflective acceptance of those teachings, then zeal arises, enthusiasm, right? We want to practice. We accept it. We came in. We listened to Shaila talk about her retreat practice and her practice of jhana and what she has learned. You've read her book, you've been to her teachings, and you feel this enthusiasm, and you want to practice it, right? And then you have this zeal, and then you apply yourself, you apply your will, and having applied your will, you discern, you scrutinize what you're experiencing, and then you strive resolutely. And you realize with the body the supreme truth, and you see it by penetrating it with wisdom. And that is how you discover the truth. So then the young man goes through and he asks, you know, how do I do this? What is the first step? And of course the first step is you go and you find somebody, and then you go, you visit them, you come to the hall, you listen to people give talks, we practice the talks, we reflect on them, we create enthusiasm for them. We develop our own practice, and we examine them. And then we pay respects. And then he goes through and goes, well, how do I know if I am becoming awakened? And he says, you will know by when you finally reflect on following the truth of your teachers, you will know, because when you touch into this truth with wisdom, then you will see that you will have the penetrating experience of insight. And so and this is one of my favorite parts, the Brahmins say to him, formerly, Master Gotama, we used to talk, we used to say, who are those bald-headed recluses, those swarthy menial offspring of the kinsmen? Who are they that understand the Dhamma? But now we understand, you have inspired love in us for the recluses. From now on, Master Gotama, remember us as lay followers who have gone for refuge for life. So that's the Kanki, Chunky Sutta, the Chunky Peanut Butter Sutta. And it is one of the most important, because the Buddha refers to it throughout the Pali Canon, this exact teaching. He refers to it over and over again in different ways, the same teaching of the worry about the five ordinary bases of truth. I want to say a little bit more about that. The fact that you have faith, the blind faith, the simple personal preference, an oral or written tradition, logical reasoning, and reflection and acceptance. And I think that's an interesting thing to think about, because, of course, it's something that we all have when we begin practicing, isn't it? When we haven't penetrated the truth. So how do you discern when it becomes a hindrance to your practice? Do you follow what I'm saying? There's a time when we first get introduced to the Dhamma, to meditation, to what we want to discover internally about the truth. And we have faith in it. We have faith in what we've been told in the oral tradition. We have faith in the written tradition, you know, reading the sutta. And we have this kind of logical reasoning. Well, you know, this person does it, and they seem to be really happy. I'm going to do it now. Yeah, it's pretty logical, right? And we reflect and we accept it. But the Buddha is saying this can go either way. It can have a positive outcome or it can have a negative outcome. And it's not the basis for truth. I was just reading Bhikkhu Bodhi on this, and he says that the big problem is that these have come out of emotion. And emotion is never stable, right? Emotion changes. So that's why you, in discovering the truth, to break this down, you have to have faith in a teacher. You approach him or her. You associate with him or her. You listen to him or her. You hear the Dhamma. You consider its meaning. You accept it after reflection. You become enthusiastic, and you attempt to practice it. Then you assess, or weigh is actually the Pali word, sorry. You weigh your experiences. Then you strive. Then you really put pedal to the metal, and then you have realization. So these are contrasted, and I think they're actually probably a graduated way of practicing. We start with these, the ones that are less sure, that have these different, as he says, it could be one way or the other, and then we move into the practices that actually will take us to the truth. I want to then, what I want to do is introduce you a little bit to the Theragata, which is just a fabulous collection. But I wanted to give you the Buddhist teachings on this first, because these are Buddhist nuns, and they have some fabulous things to say. They are just really amazing, and they're not really well read. You know, how many of you have read the Theragata or know anything about it? Yay! Anybody else? So it's part of the Pali Canon. It's in the Kundaka, the text of the Kundaka. So I just am going to read you a little bit about these nuns and tell you, give you a little bit of what they have to say. The Buddha's Buddha, historical Buddha's mother died in childbirth 7 days after he was born. And his stepmother, his mother's sister, raised him. And her name is Mahapajapati. And Pajapati was her name, and they called her Mahapajapati. And when he left home and he went off to become, abandoned the riches and his wife and child and his parents, and he went off and he became enlightened. And then he came back, and he fully enlightened, and he taught his clansmen the Dhamma, and his father died, and his mother and all of their important people, they had servants and ladies in waitings and all that sort of thing, and they were living there. And so his mother, Mahapajapati, wanted to ordain, because that's what you did. This was a time in India when it was a big movement to be what they're called samanas. They would go, these wandering ascetics would go in the jungle, and there were many of them, many different teachers. I mean, the Buddha had been one before he became the Buddha. And so the most certain way to be with a teacher was to become a wandering ascetic yourself and to become ordained. And then the Buddha would take you in, and you'd live in a monastery or with the nuns. So Mahapajapati, but not with the nuns at this point, because there weren't any. So there's a lot of stories about Mahapajapati, the mother, asking the Buddha to ordain her, to make her so that she could become a nun. And it's very controversial because there's various different texts that say different things, and scholars love to argue about them. But what's important for us is that ultimately he did ordain her, and she became the senior most and the first to become enlightened of this group of nuns. And they were called the Teri. Teri is the name of their collection of poems. Gatha just means song. Gathas are songs. And Teri, with the I at the end, means it's a feminine elder. So the elders in the sense of the first, the originals. And there's also a group of poems called the Teragata, which are the poems of the elder monks. So they lived with the Buddha, and they were taught with the Buddha. And so there's these wonderful stories about, you know, they heard the Buddha teach and they became arhats, you know, listening to him give a Dharma talk. And an arhat is, you know, an awakened being. And so they wrote these poems. Many of these poems are written about their past lives before they became nuns. But I think in reference to how we discern a trustworthy teacher, there's a few that I really want to share with you. There's a line that's repeated. In fact, I've written a couple of things about these poems, and the line that I find very interesting that comes up over and over again is a young woman joins the nunnery. She becomes a nun, a monastic, so that she can practice. But, you know, she's dealing with what we all deal with, which is, you know, her mind isn't happy, she has a hard time sitting, she's drowsy, it's hot, and she'd really like to go home and eat and watch television, or, you know, whatever, I don't know, you know, what they did in those days. So she writes in this verse, I'm going to read you the verse. She says, five times, I went out of the monastery, my heart was without peace, my heart was out of control. So she's thinking of, you know, throwing it over, leaving. And then she says, I approached a nun. She seemed like someone I could trust. She taught me the Dhamma. She taught me about what makes a person, about the senses and their objects, about the basic elements that make up everything. I listened to what she taught, did exactly as she said. For 7 days I sat in one position, legs crossed, given over to joy and happiness. On the eighth day I stretched out my feet after splitting open the mass of mental darkness. So you have to take the fact that she did this in 1 week, you take that with a grain of salt, right? This is poetry, so you have a poetic license. But what she did was she was a young nun, and she went to a Teri, an elder nun there, and she, who was someone that she could trust. So you're living in a community. If you've ever lived in a community or worked in a big community, you know there's not everybody there that you can trust. So it's very, I think, meaningful in these personal poems that they talk about that. Another one, this is a nun called Vasika. It's been 25 years since I renounced, but not a moment have I had a finger snap of peace. I never experienced the stilling of my mind. With no peace in my heart, dripping with sexual desire, I entered the monastery, wailing, my arms outstretched. So, you know, she's suffering. So what did she do? I approached a nun. She seemed like someone I could trust. It's the same line. She taught me the Dhamma, about what makes a person, about the senses and their objects, about the basic elements. Hearing the Dhamma from her, I came to her side. I practiced. I begin to know my previous life and the eye that can see the invisible. I know the ways of my heart now. I hear clearly. And then she talks about developing these meditative powers through her concentration. I want to read you a little bit about Patachara. Patachara is a very interesting and a pretty famous nun. Patachara was the daughter of a wealthy wealthy merchant, and she ran off with one of the servants of the household. It's not a great way to make your parents happy, and she had a child, and then she was about to give birth to the second child with her, and then decided with her husband to go back and give birth at home with her parents and see if they would take them all in, Patachara, her husband, the child, and the newborn that was on its way. And as she's going home, some of you may have heard this story. It gets attributed to somebody else, but this is who it really happened to. They're going and they're walking, and there's this torrential rainpour. And if you've ever been to India, when it rains, you know, the monsoon, when it rains, it's, you know, torrential is not really even a strong enough word. So she ended up giving birth on the side of the road, and her husband went to find wood to build a shelter for her and now the infant and her other child. But he didn't come back. He'd never returned. And she found him having been bitten by a snake and died. So she decided to return home on her own. And she goes to cross the river. And then there's, you know, all kinds of chaos. Depending upon the version that you're reading, she has a raft and she puts the baby on the raft and one child on the shore, so she's going to take the baby over, and a big bird comes and grabs the baby and flies off with it. And then she's crying, and then the other child sees her crying and swims out, and then that baby drowns. And then, I mean, it's just this terrible drama. I mean, it's, you know, it's so dramatic that she then is headed to her father, her parents' home, and they say that the storm actually destroyed that village, and both of her parents are dead. So she is incredibly grief-stricken, and she goes mad. And so she's wandering the streets, nude. You know, we sometimes see these people. They're not usually nude in our area, but if you go to the Tenderloin in San Francisco, you see people who've experienced horrendous trauma and have lost their minds, and they are begging, and they are... She is completely lost track. She is no longer with us. And so she goes to the Buddha, and she asks him for help. And this is the story where he sends her, he says, go to the houses, and anyone who hasn't had a death, get a mustard seed from them and bring it back to me. First you task them. And so, of course, she goes to all the neighbors, and everyone's had a death. They've all lost somebody. And she comes back, and she tells the Buddha, and then he ordains her. And she becomes a teacher of 500 of the nuns. So I wanted to, I'll give you just another couple of little vignettes, because she becomes such an important teacher. There's another nun named Chanda, and Chanda was a daughter of a Brahmin family. And she had lived in a very posh lifestyle until her family fell on hard times for whatever reason. And she had, she was a widow. She didn't have children, and she had no friends or relatives. And so she writes in her verse, in the past I was poor, a widow without children, without friends, without relatives. I did not have food or clothing. I took a bowl and a stick, and I went begging from family to family. I wandered for 7 years, tormented by cold and heat. Then I saw a nun, as she was on alms round, receiving food and drink. So if you've ever seen monks or nuns with their begging bowls going on alms round, and so she saw one. And she approached her, and she said, and I said to her, make me go forth into homelessness. That means make me ordain. And it was Patachara that she sees. And she writes, and she was sympathetic to me, and Patachara brought me into the nunnery. She ordained me, and she gave me advice and pointed me toward the highest goal. I listened to her words. I put into action her advice. That excellent woman's advice was not empty. I now know the three things that most people don't know, and nothing fouls my heart. So, clearly, you know, she found a teacher that she could trust. I mean, it's, you know, these are in some ways distant from us, but do you know if you have something in your life that's very painful, something shameful, or something, you know, you've gone through a lot of grief, or you're divorced, or you're someone has died or you've been disowned by your family, whatever reason. And, you know, it takes a lot of trust to confide that to somebody you don't know, doesn't it? I mean, you know, to go to a teacher, meditation teacher, your mind is, you know, you're so unhappy. And you say, you know, I need some help here. Can you give me some guidance? And so to find someone that this woman is, you know, the shame of being a Brahmin and being out on the streets begging for 7 years and then having this person who would help you. We're going to stop soon, but I want to share with you a couple more. There's a very interesting nun named Bada Kundalas Kesa. We'll just call her Bada. She had a fascinating backstory. So some of the stories we hear from the commentaries that came down from the nuns, some of them are listed in the poems and some of them are added later. She was a young woman, also from a wealthy family. Her father was a merchant. And she is upstairs looking out her window, and she sees this thief named Satuka being led away from prison. He has been arrested, and he's in jail, and they're taking him off to punish him. And she falls in love with him looking out the window. You know, she's probably a teenager, what can we say? And so she goes to her father and she says, you know, I cannot live without this man. And her father, of course, buys his release. And so she and Satuka, they get married and she becomes a very devoted wife. So he decides he wants to take her on a little bit of a sightseeing tour. And so she gets all dressed up in her fancy clothes with her fancy jewels and everything. And so he takes her up into the mountains. And she figures out that he's going to try to take her jewels and push her over the edge of the mountain. And having figured that out, she pushes him. So she kills him. And she realizes, well, I probably can't go home now, you know, because my dad, like, bought this guy, and I married him, and, you know, like, it's probably not okay for me to go home. So she became a Jain nun. Now, Mahavira was the leader of the Jains, and he was a contemporary of the historic Buddha. And so she shaves her head, and they don't bathe or clean their teeth, or at least they didn't at that time. And she goes wandering around India, and she's debating. And she says, I once wandered with hair cut off, covered with dirt, wearing only one cloth. I thought there was fault where there was none. I saw no fault where there were fault. And so she's debating. That was a time when there were these ascetic monks and nuns who became really skilled at debating those 5 points, right? These things that you can have opinions about. The things you read, the logic, those sorts of things. And so that's what she's doing, and she's winning because she's, you know, I mean, she killed somebody, so she's got to be pretty tough. So she meets Sariputta, you know, one of the Buddha's closest disciples, and she, of course, she engages him in debate and doesn't win. And so he tells her, well, you should go forth and meet the Buddha. So then what happens is she's still a Jain nun, and she's sitting outside reflecting on Jain philosophy, philosophical doctrines, and she's thinking about them, and she's kind of deep in this thought. And all of a sudden, a dog comes, and again, if you spend time in India, the place is, you know, there's all these feral dogs everywhere, and so you can just kind of imagine this. The dog approaches her, and she's sitting there, you know, on the ground, and the dog walks up, and he's got something in his mouth, and he drops it, and it's a human hand crawling with maggots. So this provoked deep spiritual shock in Bhadra. First time I translated this, it provoked deep spiritual shock in me. You know, it's like, what? And so she ends up, she says that she needs to find someone who can explain the significance of this. And so she goes and she finds the Buddha. And the Buddha meets her and he ordains her by saying, "Come, Bada." And then she's ordained. So she's actually ordained and taught by the Buddha. So there's many more. I wanted to give you a little bit of a flavor. It goes on. The one that I wanted to tell you, because I'm going to try to give you the, you know, a survey at least, is the Upalavana. And Upalavana was, she and her mother were married off to the same man. And so she, and then, you know, these are things that happened in antiquity. So there's a lot of books on the role of women in this particular time. And she says, I'll read you just a little bit, and then I want to have a couple minutes for questions. "We were mother and daughter, but we shared one husband. I was afraid of what had to come from that. It was perverse and made my hair stand on end. Sexual urges, let them be cursed. They are dirty, foul, dangerous. And they were right there where mother and daughter shared one husband." And then she goes on and she says that she, seeing the danger in lust, I went to a nun and I went from home into homelessness. So she became a nun herself. One of the things that's most interesting about Upalavana, and she shows up in all traditions. She's in the Mahayana tradition. She's written about in the Vajrayana tradition. So she's got mythic status. I mean, everybody's heard of her. Is that she's developed these amazing powers in her meditation. So she, not only does she know her previous lives, and she has the eye that can see the invisible, but when the Buddha was coming to visit and she wanted to see him, she produced from nothing, this is from her poem, "With those powers I produced from nothing a chariot with four horses. I worshipped the feet of the Buddha, the protector of the world like none other." And then Smara, who's the bad guy of Buddhism, is there, and she sees him, and she says, "You came to this tree in full bloom." Oh, no, this is Mara speaking to her. "You came to this tree in full bloom, and you now stand there all alone." So he's threatening rape to her. It's one of the common themes of this collection. And she says, "Even if 100,000 rapists were to come, I would not turn a hair, nor would I flinch one bit. So, Mara, what will you do when it is just you all by yourself? Maybe I will just disappear, or maybe I will get inside your belly." This is what she's saying to him. "Maybe I will stand between your eyebrows, but wherever it may be, you won't see me where I am standing. I have my mind under control. Powers beyond normal are mine to use. The six powers have been attained by me. The teachings of the Buddha is done." So, just to let you know, these are not placid, you know, calm, kind of, you know, like we all should be like that, even though they're kind of boring nuns. These are like real people. And the other thing that's interesting about this collection, as I was studying it, when I was writing a chapter for a book that's coming out, that when they're putting the Pali Canon together, after 30 years after the Buddha's death, they had all the collections. As you know, they had been collected orally. You know, the Ananda and various different monks had memorized the teachings, and they'd been systematized so that they could remember them. And these poems were part of the ones that they had memorized, all of them. They went through, and like all spiritual traditions, they separated the ones they didn't think were real. You know, these are not really helpful. This, you know, this one kind of got exaggerated over here. You know, this one we've already heard 44 times, so we're going to leave it out. But this one they kept, and they kept the ones from the monks too, which I think is fascinating, really, because of the role of women at that time. Women were, except for the Buddha, I mean, he was very radical in his ordaining women and allowing them to live in monasteries on their own, and to claim that women could become enlightened. Mahavira ordained nuns, but it was a different role. They didn't have the path to enlightenment. So anyway, I think that's, I would like to encourage everyone to go buy this volume and read them. Not really. I don't know that it would appeal to everyone, But this is a great collection. It's a new translation, and it's done in a contemporary language. So if you're interested, there it is. Thank you for listening to this. I don't know if it was at all interesting to you. It was interesting to me. So I hope you got something from it at least.